First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
Should the city declare a housing emergency? Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, one candidate for city council says it's time for city officials to do more to tackle the housing crisis. We'll speak with Joshua Higgs. You can join us, 549-2937. Then later, local favorites Tedeschi Trucks have won a national following and critical acclaim. We'll check in with the band about their new music and the kickoff of their summer tour this weekend at Daly's Place. All of that ahead. But first this hour, from unaffordable housing to crumbling infrastructure to trash pickup, one local candidate says it's time for a new approach in Jacksonville on a range of issues. And he's calling for a local housing emergency to address skyrocketing rents. City Council candidate at large group 2, Joshua Higgs, is holding a town hall on this later this week. He has a preview now in studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you?
Good to have you. So here's our question to callers. Should Jacksonville declare a housing emergency? Are you having trouble paying the rent or mortgage or buying a home? We want to hear from you. Give us a call. It's 549-2937, 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect at wjct.org. Tweets to at Melissa in Jax. Facebook always open. So you're running at large group 2. Your opponent is Ron Salem. You're a Democrat. And one of the big issues you've been calling out, Joshua Higgs, is housing, skyrocketing rent prices. You say Jacksonville should declare a housing emergency. Tell us why you've decided to campaign on this issue.
Absolutely. That's a great question. Thank you. Well, I've actually called for a housing emergency here in Jacksonville because, you know, we're seeing skyrocketing rents go through the roof here in Jacksonville, not only in Jacksonville, but in Florida and across the country. And, you know, our city council continues to sit on their hands. They're not having public meetings. They're not holding any finance meetings. And my opponent is the finance chair of the council. So I believe we need an official declaration on the housing emergency from the city so that we stop ignoring the problem. And, you know, an example of why is, you know, you take the Arlington community, the zip code up there, 322. The rent cost went up 61% last year. In that Arlington community. That's an average of $800 more a month for an average family. Mm. They can't afford that. So to have a council sitting on their hands, not actually holding hearings, trying to come up with solutions, one councilman tweeted, we just need to build more. That doesn't make sense. That's not a policy. That's not a strategic plan. That's not a solution for our community. We need actual leaders to take a stand for their neighbors, for our community, and say, yes, this is a problem, and this is how we're going to address it.
If the city were to declare a housing emergency, you say that would unlock some potential solutions, such as?
It would. It would first open up some additional federal and state funding that we could get by declaring a housing emergency. We would be able to streamline some of the resources that we can use to our advantage, like taking dormant properties on a quicker basis as a city without having to go through some of the bureaucratic red tape.
All right. Miami has declared an emergency over its housing crisis. That's one large Florida city that has done this. The city of Tampa has made some noise about this. Some lawmakers have asked the governor to declare a state of emergency on housing. St. Pete is voting to explore declaring a housing state of emergency. So some cities are going after this in a more aggressive manner. In Jacksonville, there does not seem to be the political will to do this. You're running at large. You would represent the entire city. What's your response to those who like Ron Salem on the city council and plan to vote Republican?
You know, I respect their vote, but what I will tell them is, you know, a city councilman, especially elected at large, should be representing the entire community, not a political party, not a political base. He shouldn't be selling out his vote to the mayor. He should.
What do you mean by that?
You know, his consultant is Tim Baker. Ron Salem tends to back whatever Lenny Curry wants, whether it's Lot J. Whether
would you have voted against Lot J?
I would have voted against Lot J. I do not believe in giving $350 million of our taxpayer dollars to a billionaire who doesn't even live in Jacksonville. He's not paying property taxes. Lot J was a bad deal for taxpayers. I would have voted against it. My opponent voted for it. These are, you know, as a voter, you need to look at, is your representative representing you? And are they doing it well? There was a recent poll back when during the Nick Hallin and Tracy Polson race back in February that showed the approval rating of the city council is 31% in Jacksonville. There's a reason for that. It's because when people ask for things from their local government, whether it's waste management, well, whether it's decades of broken promises on infrastructure, or whether it's not getting evicted because of this housing crisis, the city council is not acting. There's no strategic plan. There's no plan for the future. They act in the moment, and oftentimes it's not with the citizens' best interest in mind. It's their own political egos or ambitions.
It's 549-2937 to speak with Joshua Hicks, candidate for the Jacksonville City Council. You'll have the opportunity to vote in this race. It's an at-large race. Get the ballot. Study the candidates and issues. Mark the primary date on your calendar of August 23rd, whoever you choose to vote for, and give us a call, 549-2937. You mentioned infrastructure. Here's a tweet from a listener. Before we start building more housing, what are the city's infrastructure plans? Water, sewer, waste removal, roads, power. Mm-hmm. Not much can be done cost-wise due to federal policy, although at some point that shoe will drop. He's talking about the Fed propping up the housing market. Oh, you know, I think your opponent, Mr. Salem, and others on the council would disagree with you that they haven't looked at infrastructure needs in the city of Jacksonville, that they have made a number of initiatives over the years to work on infrastructure problems. What about that?
You know, I would say there's hundreds of projects currently sitting on the backlog in parts of the city that need it most. You know, projects in the richest part of towns can be started and finished before most individuals know that construction's even happening. You know, in communities of need, we're still waiting for thousands of, you know, homes to have their septics changed to sewer. There is a plan to do that, but you know, they're still building new properties with septic tanks. There's a plan to address the septic tanks that are currently in place, but there's not a plan to address the septic tanks that are actually going in currently. And when you talk about streetlights, you know, sidewalks, filling potholes, these are basic infrastructure problems that the community has been demanding for years, especially some communities in need that have been ignored since consolidation. But infrastructure doesn't stop there for me. It goes into your city parks, making sure that park fundings, we have some of the best parks in the country. We should have the number one park city in the country. But we don't put the resources in it, not only to make sure they're taken care of for our children and for our families, but also that they're accessible to individuals in need. But you also talk about transit, and transit is part of infrastructure, in my opinion. We have old bus lines that get people downtown but won't get them home to their communities still, because we haven't changed those lines for decades. They were put in place before consolidation. They were put in place during segregation. And, you know, JTA isn't responsible for really updating those bus lines, and the city sort of is letting things go. So when we actually want to address, improving infrastructure, we have to look at all of these issues as one, all of these items as one, and really focus on the community. I'm a career nonprofit professional with 20 years of experience working for nonprofits. I go to work every day trying to help people, whether it's cancer patients or survivors or for environmental protections or supporting young elected officials throughout my career. I've gone to work rolling up my sleeves to support our community, and I just want that leadership on the city council. Folks who are going to show up for their neighbors, show up for their families and friends, and put their community first, not their own egos.
We'll go to your calls for Joshua Hicks in a moment, 549-2937. If you were to be elected at large to the city council, you'd be the only white Democrat on the city council. And it's my understanding you'd be the first openly gay member of the Jacksonville City Council.
That would be correct.
How would you advocate for marginalized communities in this city if you were to be elected?
Yeah. That's 100% correct. I would be the first openly gay Democrat elected to the city council. And, you know, it's concerning some of the federal stuff we're seeing. You're seeing it now on the school board with the Don't Say Gay bill. People are coming for certain rights. constitutional rights, in my opinion. We need leadership on the council to strengthen and expand the HRO. We're losing some allies. We lost Tommy Hazori. Garrett Dennis is running for our state house. So it's concerning that there's a group of people in Jacksonville who would rather take rights away rather than strengthen and expand rights that are given to some members of the community through the HRO. I go to work every day. I've worked for the SEIU. I've worked in nonprofits.
Can you explain to people what that is for those who don't understand
Service
that?
Service Employees International, a union. I've worked for the League of Conservation Voters. I currently work for the Colorectal Cancer Alliance. I go to work every day working for people, working for the communities, trying to stand up for those without a voice, trying to stand up for those who are trying to suppress voices. And on the city council, if we have community leaderships, if we have an actual community activist who's been rolling up his sleeves, getting out at whether it's protests or rallies or important events at the city hall for city council meetings, CPAC meetings, community advisory meetings, if we have someone who's active and actively involved in the community and is part of the LGBTQ plus community, I think that would only help to serve Jacksonville in the long-term interest of actually becoming a more inclusive community, but also spreading equity across the community. One community should not be treated differently than another. We need to make sure that the resources going into one community is also going into the all of our communities, and that's what I plan to do.
Let's go to your calls now for Joshua Hicks, running at large for the Jacksonville City Council. The primary election is in August. Lots of candidates on the ballot, also a property tax hike question for schools. You need to go to DuvalElections.com, study up, and make sure you vote, whoever you choose. What are your questions for this candidate? 549-2937, Cecilia in Jacksonville. Hi, Cecilia.
Hi, how are you?
All right, thanks for calling.
Hi, Cecilia.
Oh, hi. I spent most of my adult life, please excuse me, I'm losing my voice, working with those people experiencing homelessness. And I was wondering if you're going to be working with the COC. My concern is, COC is not capturing accurate data.
And the COC, meaning?
Continuum of care.
Continuum of care. Okay.
It's changing homelessness here in Jacksonville.
Changing homelessness, yes. Okay.
And they didn't capture accurate data in the last point in time. How are you going to help us reflect the real need?
Thank you for that question. You're going to be talking about this at a town hall tomorrow night?
I will. Tomorrow night. Yes, absolutely. You know, one of the first things we can do as a community is we need to raise the level of city investment in affordable housing programs. We've spent $4 million in the 2021-2022 budget, whereas you're seeing other cities like Asheville and St. Louis. St. Louis, for example, spent $75 million 2 years ago on the housing issue. And that's money that they can, put into the nonprofits, into some churches, into some organizations here in Jacksonville who are already on the ground supporting people, whether it's providing food, shelter, warm water, a place to go to cover rent, utilities, et cetera, to help people during this time of crisis, because this is what it is. It's a housing crisis. I had someone in Jacksonville Beach during the Move for Change event on Sunday come up to me and say she was getting evicted two weeks from now. And I asked her where she's going to go, and she said, I'm going to be in my car because I don't have a place to go at the moment. And the city doesn't have any short-term plans to address this. Creating additional funding, not patting ourselves on the back for $4 million when we're prepared to spend $350 million and give it to a billionaire.
You're talking about Shad Khan.
I'm Shad Khan.
All right, let me play devil's advocate
sure.
on that question.
Sure.
For those who support incentives for the Jaguars mm-hmm. and support giving some public funds to help Shad Khan build along the waterfront,
yeah.
they see that as an economic development driver. What's your response?
My response is Lot J was a bad deal for the community. The follow-up deal that actually went through the correct process through DIA was a much better deal, a dollar-for-dollar deal for the community, and that's what we need. We need better oversight, better transparency, better accountability of our local officials. And if you include the DIA and other organizations to actually walk through the correct process, we can get some good deals for development. I'm not anti-development. We need a thriving thriving downtown. We need more a more robust downtown in terms of density. We need to build downtown up so that we can bring people back to the community to take advantage of our parks, to take advantage of our sports teams, to support our arts, culture, restaurants. But we need to spend more on the pressing problems also of today. And $4 million, I'm sorry, is a meager amount of money. And I'm looking forward to this year's budget. I'm hoping that number increases this year when the budget's announced later this month or early next month. But, you know, I'm not holding my breath because currently the council has not done anything to address the housing crisis. And as the caller said, we need to actually be putting more additional funding and more resources into this problem to help people who are being evicted today. 2,600 people just in the last 3 or 4 months here in Jacksonville have been evicted, not through any fault of their own, because developers have raised their cost, landlords have raised their costs, so they were forced out of their place of residence. And to me, that's just not right.
We're getting lots of tweets, emails, and calls for City Council candidate Joshua Hicks, 549-2937, Joe in Atlantic Beach. Hi, Joe. Go ahead.
Sure, Melissa.
Thanks.
Can you hear?
Yep, go ahead.
Can you? Yes. My question is, as a vegan, fresh fruits and vegetables and affordable plant-based foods are very important to me. What is Mr. Joshua going to do regarding food deserts or food apartheid in Jacksonville where you cannot buy fresh fruits and vegetables at an affordable price? Thank you.
Thanks for that. You know, whether it's food deserts, old bus lines, unaffordable housing, people still living on septic tanks, all of these issues are connected.
They really are. I was honored to go to the Deb's Store reopening in Historic East Side, a great program that Lift Jacks is producing, is developing. And, you know, we need more of that. We need housing, or we need food desert solutions in some of our communities of need. And, you know, part of this is just the fact that, you know, we have certain elected officials who aren't looking out either for their district that they were elected to look out for, or we have some at-large candidates or some constitutional office city officials who, you know, just aren't part of those communities. So they don't, it's out of sight, out of mind.
Should the city not have at-large? You're running at-large. There have been rumblings that we don't need all of these at-large offices.
I think if you have candidates or elected officials in place holding these positions that actually look out for the entire community and not just for their own personal, you know, political gains, the at-large seats can be an advantage. They were set up in a way to make sure that there's someone from every part of the community, every part of Duval County running. That's why we have the groups. We run in groups, but we run at-large. So having these groups allow us to have five different candidates from all different parts of Duval County. Now, is that something we want to consider, you know, potentially getting rid of down the road? That's something I'll look at, because if we have these five at-large seats that aren't going to actually stand up
to get rid of your seat that you hold
if I feel it saves the city money, if I feel it means that government will be more responsive to the people. I'm not a career politician. I'm not running to make a career out of this. I'm running to be a community leader who wants to stand up for the next 4 to 8 years for my neighbors, for my friends and families, and get things done. And if we can have a more effective government without having an at-large seat, I would give that bill a consideration that I believe Garrett Dennis introduced. Now, that bill did not pass this past city council session, and it would have to be reintroduced and discussed. But yeah, it should definitely not be ruled off the table as a possible solution to make better government for Jacksonville in the future.
Let's get to a few tweets about the housing crisis for candidate Joshua Hicks. One problem, says a listener, is that too many people are converting homes and condos into Airbnbs. Here is another tweet for you from Brian. Should the city subsidize rent?
That's a good question. Well, I think the city should definitely, you know, make sure that we're taking advantage of every single possible resource that's available to us. One of the things we can do is, you know, if we streamline the permitting process to remove current construction barriers and rethink zoning to allow more affordable multifamily housing units and neighborhoods, then that will qualify us for a new loan grant program that President Biden just actually announced a few weeks ago, and put money into our community to actually put that towards multifamily housing units and neighborhoods.
So that sounds like you wouldn't be in favor of rent subsidies.
I'm in favor of putting money into temporary housing solutions, whether it's nonprofits and churches, to actually provide something, provide fresh water, fresh food, roof over folks' heads if they get evicted in the short term.
That would be different from a rent subsidy check,
yes.
All right, here's a tweet from Matthew. Do you plan on upzoning neighborhoods close to the urban core to increase housing supply? Do you have plans for transit-oriented development to accommodate denser housing?
First question, yes. We actually need to, I mentioned this earlier, we need to create more density in downtown. We need to build downtown up. We can't just have parking garages in downtown. We need to have good apartments, affordable units. So we need to be working with developers to incentivize them to put 10-15% of those units off to the side for actually affordable housing units. We're 40,000 housing units in the hole on the national average in terms of where we should be for affordable housing. So we need to address that. The second question, yes. If we're building up these units in the urban core, we need to make sure our bus routes and our systems, they're built next to current bus stations, current bus routes, so that people have access to them. But we also, as I mentioned earlier, need to look at our bus lines in general. We need more buses. We need more workers. So we need to pay workers a living wage. But we also need to make sure that we're rezoning and redrawing some of these bus lines to make sure that in communities of need, people can get downtown for work and entertainment, to enjoy their lives, but they can also get home. Because oftentimes we have quite a few members of our community who don't go downtown because there's not a bus system or there's not an advantage to going downtown for them. So they're in their communities and they're often overlooked. And we need to change that as a community.
Mark on the line in St. Augustine. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning. First, I agree there is a housing problem, affordability and that kind of thing. And I'll admit I'm ignorant as to, you know, how to go about correcting it. But I kind of wonder if there's already a correction in place and maybe we'll see the results in a year to maybe 2 years. And that is, with the Fed raising interest rates and making it harder for people to borrow money, will that result in some of these properties that are being built actually having rents come down from the standpoint of not being as lucrative as it is right now? I mean, whenever I drive around Jackson, I'll see beautiful apartments going up, but I know they're expensive. And maybe that's because money has been so inexpensive, they're building them very nice and they want to get a premium for them. But if they kind of put the brakes on the real estate market through the action of increased interest rates, will that result in the market being such that the rates will have to come down just to put bodies in the apartments?
Thanks, Mark. Yeah, interest rates, what the Fed will do to put the brakes on inflation could have localized effects.
It could, definitely. And, you know, Duval County is growing rapidly. We're a city of over a million people now. Some estimates say we're going to be at 2 million in the next 40 years. That's how fast we're growing. So there's going to be the need for housing. There's going to be need for new developments. And right now we're having a bunch of out-of-state developers, out-of-the-area developers come in, buy up some of these properties that are Jacksonville owned, develop it, raise costs based off of where they're from, what they think they can get for those buildings. And then you see other developers swoop in and also raise their cost to match those because, you know, you don't want to get beat in those situations. So that is causing the increase to occur. Now, as a city, we have a responsibility to make sure that any out-of-state developers that are coming in, maybe we work with them to see, hey, if you want to raise our costs by an enormous amount and put strain on our families here in Jacksonville. Maybe it's right if you pay an out-of-state fee that goes into a housing fund here in Jacksonville that we can then put into an affordable housing.
That would be a huge change for the Jacksonville City Council, which is traditionally seen as extraordinarily friendly to the development sector.
Absolutely. But, you know, it wouldn't cost the developers all that much money. They're still making money based off of the new developments. There's still an out-of-state developer coming in and buying our land here in Jacksonville. The city should be more protective about what our resources are and not just be willing to give it away to an outside builder just because of cost.
With all of that said, you are holding a town hall tomorrow night in the city with the call to action. You say the city needs to declare a housing emergency. How can people participate in your event?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the town hall tomorrow night is going to be at Pastor Dawson's, another Pastor Dawson's, Another Chance Breakthrough Ministries. It's going to be at 7 p.m., and that's at 1405 State Street West, Jacksonville, Florida. Again, it's 7 p.m. to 8 p.m., and it's going to be an open town hall discussing not only the housing crisis, but also the jobs market here in Jacksonville, and how we can create more better-paying jobs, stronger living wage, but also get people off their feet and make sure that, you know, they're having a better way of life for everybody.
Joshua Hicks, candidate for City Council at-large Group 2. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Melissa.
We hope to have more candidates and current office holders on in the lead-up to the August primary election in the city. Learn more about all of the races at DuvalElections.com. Make sure you vote, too. Well, much more still ahead later. A little good news to brighten up your Wednesday, but up next.
As soon as the lockdown pretty much happened, we came off the road in March of 2020. By August of 2020, we were already started, you know, writing a bunch of songs.
Tedeschi Trucks kicks off their summer tour in Jacksonville with lots of great new music. We'll take a listen next.
Northeast Florida artists are making noise that's reverberating across the country, and the Jacksonville Music Experience is your ticket to the local scene. Music reviews, curated playlists, music history, concert recommendations, and profiles of local artists, all put together by our team of local contributors. The Jacksonville Music Experience plays it local and plays it loud. Visit jacksmusic.org to read and hear more.
Welcome back. Well, that's a new tune from the Grammy Award-winning Tedeschi Trucks Band. They're out this summer with the first of four new albums. Now, the much-loved local favorites have built a national following, and they're gearing up to begin their summer tour in Jacksonville this Friday at Daly's Place. I got a preview of the tour and the music from Susan Tedeschi. Here's that conversation. Susan Tedeschi, a pleasure. Thanks for being with us. Good to talk to you.
It's wonderful to talk to you. Thanks for having me, Melissa.
It's exciting to talk about all of the new projects you have at Tedeschi Trucks Band. Such leading lights of our local music scene, and you're nationally renowned too. So four new albums out, and you're starting the summer tour on the 24th at Daly's Place. You guys have been busy.
We have. We've been really busy. We have a very, exciting schedule for this year, so we're pretty excited.
Now, in a moment, we'll talk about the show at Daly's Place, but first, if you could, tell me a little bit about I Am the Moon. This is what sure looks to be an epic undertaking. Four albums, 24 original songs. That's a lot of new material.
It is. It is a lot of new material, and it's been interesting because it just came about very organically. As soon as the lockdown pretty much happened, you know, the pandemic started, we came off the road in March of 2020. And by August of 2020, we were already started, you know, writing a bunch of songs and collaborating our ideas on Zoom, as well as trying to get together at a meeting point with some of the band. You know, we have a 12-piece band, but the core of the band mostly is based in Atlanta, Georgia, and then Derek and I are here in Jacksonville, and then Gabe Dixon is up in Nashville. So we all kind of drove to each other in middle Georgia and started working on this project, you know, really just started collaborating and showing each other our ideas. And Mike Madison was really the the catalyst of this entire project. He gave us the idea to dive into the Leila Majnun poem from Nizimi from the 12th century and to come at it from a different point of view. You know, what about Layla's point of view, or what about some of the other characters in this epic poem? So, you know, it was really a beautiful thing to do, and just to have almost like a homework assignment to do during the thing. So, you know, during the time off, it really wasn't time off. You know, we were actually staying active and you know, communicating as a band and just staying connected during the entire time, which is really nice.
That is nice. Now, in addition to I Am the Moon, the album, actually four albums, there's also a film that corresponds to this release. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so again, Mike Madison, our catalyst for this whole project, really, a lot of this is, you know, sort of brainstormed from him and Derek. And his friend Alex Lambert is this amazing documentarian. Phil, you know, she's everything from a director and a filmmaker. And she just does all these different types of mediums within it. And it was his idea to have her maybe make a movie to go along with it, listening to the band and knowing us and, like, doing, you know, some live footage of us, some, you know, from a session, and then some totally different material all kind of coming together and just being a visual where you can just sit in one place, visually see some of the band and some other ethereal things that kind of go by, and it just helps you kind of lock in and listen to the music and have an experience with it. And it was really a really beautiful concept. And so each record, so the first record is Crescent, the second one Ascension, the third one The Fall, and the last one Farewell, each one will have a movie that coincides with it. And then when all four come out, they actually all piece together as one movie. So it will be a movie that you can maybe someday see in a movie theater, you know, which is kind of cool too, but it's actually the record. So it was really made to be alongside the record. So really the record is the main project, but it's such a visual world that we live in. People like to have something to look at, and it just kind of keeps your attention on the music.
Yeah, a real multimedia experience. And so
exactly,
there's excitement that you're kicking off your summer tour right in your hometown, Friday night, yes, June 24th at Daly's Place. People can come out and hear the new music.
Yes, and there's still tickets available, so come on out. I mean, it's going to be so much fun. We were just there for Dave Matthews, and Derek and I got to sit in and play with Dave, and that was a blast. And the people just seem so excited. You know, it's just so nice to see people out and enjoying the outdoors and a concert. And, you know, it's been a hard couple of years, and, you know, we need each other. People need to have the human interaction.
Absolutely. And it's exciting to see all of the success with Tedeschi Trucks Band across the country as you build that fan base from right here in North Florida. So congrats on that, and have a great show. Susan Tedeschi, one half, or one piece, one very important piece of the Tedeschi Trucks Band. Yeah, one of 12, actually. But Susan, it's great to talk to you. Have a great show. Have a great tour this summer.
Well, thank you so much. And I just want to say a little shout out to you guys, because, you know, NPR is my favorite, and I listen to you guys every day in my car in Jacksonville, and I'm also a fan of your show as well, Melissa Ross, so thank you very much.
Oh, that's great. Thank you.
And, yeah, and I'm also a supporter, so people,
fantastic,
get out and support your local NPR stations, because we need you.
Absolutely. You'll have to come in and do a pledge drive with us sometime. Susan Tedeschi,
I love it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Well, the day Russia invaded Ukraine, Pravda Brewery in the city of Lviv stopped making beer and started making Molotov cocktails. Then the owners posted their beer recipes online and put out a call to craft breweries around the world. Brew One Up to raise money and awareness for Ukraine. Local breweries are taking up that challenge, and they invite you to join them Saturday at Alewife in Five Points. It's called Beer for Bombs, and it's based on Pravda Brewery's Ukrainian Imperial Stout. We've got a preview now as we welcome Joe Pye of Broward Beer. Hey, Joe.
Hey, how are you?
Good to have you. And Kelly Pickard, co-owner of Alewife. Hi, Kelly.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Good to have you. In a moment, we'll hear what's happening at Alewife. But first, Joe, let me begin with you. You're a home brewer, a beer blogger, a journalist, and you've been working to raise awareness about this effort. Tell us all about it.
Sure. You know, as you briefly like mentioned about Pravda Brewery and how they had to stop production of their beer, start making Molotov cocktails. I, on my blog, there's a lot of beer bloggers out there who like to review beer, talk about the liquid itself. To me, I'm far more interested in the human aspect of it. I love the idea of, the people behind the beer. So when I came across this story, it was a lot of, social media posts, and I just wanted to learn more about the actual, what's going on. So I reached out to Pravda Brewery through their social media accounts and was very surprised when they got back to me. So I set up an interview with the PR guy. His name is Taras Noselko. And we had a quick interview in the morning. God, this is months ago now. And I wrote a story in my blog just basically as a call to action. There's this Ukrainian brewery, and they're offering up their recipes. They're offering up their graphics. And it's just, help them out in their situation, their time in need. Basically act as a contract brewery to brew their beer recipes, raise some money, raise some awareness. And, the story itself didn't get much engagement. I was kind of surprised by that. So I wanted to take it a step further. I mean, basically, I published a story. I remember going to sleep that night and just kind of feeling to myself, I just can't stop thinking about this project. And as you mentioned, as a journalist, I volunteer for an organization called the Society of Professional Journalists. I'm a board member of the Florida chapter. It's a nonprofit. It's the nation's oldest, nonprofit journalism trade, organization. And I was talking to a couple other members, and they're basically, we have all these funds that we raise by, doing competition journalism awards and whatnot. So I was told that, I will get you the funding to get this beer made if you can find a brewery who can do it. And immediately I just started going through all the contacts. I've been running this blog about 2 years now, so I just went through everybody I knew and was able to find a very large production facility called 26 Degree Brewing in Pompano Beach, Florida. They're known for doing contract brewing, which in the craft beer world is sometimes kind of frowned upon because it's not, they make their own recipes and they have their own beer styles and whatnot, but they're known for kind of making beer for other people who don't have the equipment to do so. But it works out perfectly with a project like this because that's really what Pravda in Ukraine wants. They want someone to make their recipes for them because they can't do it. So essentially when we met up with the owners, a guy by the name Jonathan Kiersey, he's one of the co-owners there, he fell in love with the idea of doing it because it's kind of just a perfect fit for his brewery. They're known for doing contract brewing. When we did go in for the brew day with him, fell in love with the idea that they were so into just staying so authentic to the original recipe. Pravda puts out a beer. It's called From Stan to Dawn. The Imperial Stout in the beer world is usually known as a Russian Imperial Stout. It's a higher volume beer. It's usually around 10% alcohol, to anywhere from 10 to 16% alcohol. It's known for very roasty notes, creamy mouthfeel. It's a darker beer. But what I love about this beer is that they use smoked malt in it, and it's around 9.5% alcohol, so it's not incredibly overbearing of a beer to drink. It's very drinkable. So yeah, I mean, we made a 15 barrel batch of it, which that's, if you put it in perspective, it's four large barrel kegs. And then aside from that, I mean, we just had thousands of cans of this beer. So we had our first fundraiser at their actual tap room. We raised over $6,500 in one night. Further from there, by this point, we've now raised $8,600, and we're taking it to Jacksonville. We're very lucky and fortunate to have friends up in Jacksonville. Kelly from Alewife is very supportive and wants to have us there.
Let's talk to Kelly. Let's bring you in. Tell us about what's going to be happening at Alewife Saturday at Beer for Bombs at this event and how people can be part of it. This sounds like an amazing local way to support Ukraine.
Yeah, absolutely. As Joe mentioned, I think across the beer world, when Pravda made the post, everyone saw it and wanted to know how to get involved. So I think this is an opportunity as a space for ALY, similar to what Joe said about being interested more than just the liquid. We like to think of ourselves as a community-oriented space. And so this is an opportunity for people to feel like they can have a direct impact and support when they come on site on Saturday. We're going to kick things off at 6 o'clock. We are going to have that beer available in can format, so people will be able to buy beer to take home. We'll also have it available on site for people to enjoy. And every time they're purchasing that beer, we're helping to raise funds for this effort. Additionally, we've had some other community partners donate some goods that people will be able to purchase, with proceeds going towards the Beer for Moms effort. We have a local Ukrainian cafe that is donating some pierogies.
And is that Odessa Slava Ukrainian Cafe in Five Points?
Yeah.
Right. And they're great.
Yeah, so it's just an opportunity for people, for people to actually feel like they can offer direct support and do more than maybe just making some kind of online donation and not sure where their money is going or how it's being used. So it's a way to not only create community, but also have money and funds going directly to a contact that that Joe has helped create.
You can even get a T-shirt, and proceeds go all the way to Lviv, Ukraine, to Pravda Brewery. This effort has collected more than $50,000 so far. Joe, if there's anyone in the world that needs a drink right now, it's the good people of Ukraine. So when people come out to Alewife Saturday, they'll even get a tutorial, a stout-style tutorial as well, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I just, it is such an original style of beer. Many people put out an Imperial Stout. The Ukrainian Imperial Stout, it's just something that creates its own identity for Pravda. We can go over the details of the recipe on the night. And I was just so impressed by the way this, 26 Degree was able to just completely stay authentic to Pravda. There are a lot of breweries around the world right now who are contributing to this effort. And often with these kind of projects, people, they manipulate the recipes, they change it a little bit, just based off their customer base. And there's nothing wrong with that. But I just truly wanted to tell a story of Pravda Brewery and what's going on with them in Ukraine. So that's one of the things that you can't, down here in South Florida, well, in Jacksonville will be up. But, it's a Ukrainian beer in Florida, which to me is an amazing story. So I'm really looking forward to talking to people about that.
Check it out, folks. Come on out to Alewife in Five Points. Take a taste of the Pravda Brewery's Ukrainian Imperial Stout and help raise money for Ukraine. This is going to be a great time, and I want to thank you both so much for being with us. Joe Pye of Broward Beer on the line, along with Kelly Pickard, co-owner of Alewife. Have fun. Thanks so much, guys, for being with us.
Thank you very much
for having us.
And there's more at their website, beerforbombs.com/Jax. Check that out. In a moment, everything from plants being grown in lunar soil at the University of Florida to some other good news. It's all next in our What's Good Wednesdays, so don't go away.
During a busy day, it can be hard to make room for even one more thing. So it's a real plus that All Things Considered from NPR News is great for multitaskers. You can confidently add being well-informed to your to-do list and know that you will get it done. Whether you're cleaning out your junk drawer on a quick drive or something else, listen to All Things Considered every weekday afternoon.
Starting at 4 on WJCT News 89.9. I'm Robin Young.
Welcome. Yes, come in.
The granddaughter of Ukrainian artist who spirited his paintings out of the Soviet Union decades ago shows them to the head of a Ukrainian art museum who just fled the war and came to the U.S.
This is amazing, and I start to think about how many more we don't know.
Next time, here and now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, the hidden world around us, the sights, smells, tastes, sounds, vibrations, and magnetic fields that are imperceptible to humans but are perceived by various animals, birds, fish, and insects. We'll talk with science writer Ed Yong about his new book, An Immense World, and we'll talk about covering COVID for The Atlantic. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
It's been a year since the Surfside condo building collapsed in Florida, a disaster that killed 98 people. Of the 1.5 million condo units in the state, more than half were built 30-plus years ago, just like the building in Surfside. What's happened a year since Surfside, and would any of it prevent a similar tragedy? That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, scientists at the University of Florida are growing plants in soil from the moon. It's a first ever in human history and a milestone in lunar and space exploration. Stephen Emilardo, NASA early career fellow and assistant professor with the Department of Geological Sciences at UF in Gainesville, told us more.
So what prompted this was the long-term efforts of my co-authors, Annalisa Paul and Rob Farrell, in Horticulture Sciences at the University of Florida. They run what's called the Space Plants Lab. And so they have been studying for a number of years now how a particular plant called Arabidopsis responds to different space-like environments. They've sent it to the International Space Station. They've sent it on suborbital flights. And so a natural outgrowth of that research was to test, well, how does the plant actually grow in soil from another planetary body, in this case, the moon?
Okay, so what were the findings? Did it grow? What happened?
It grew. The plant actually grew in soil from the moon, which is a pretty amazing thing if you think about it. The first time that this has ever been tried, the plant actually grew in lunar soil. Now, it wasn't particularly happy about it. It showed a lot of stress responses. So it was sort of small in size compared to plants, the same plant that was grown in a lunar soil simulant made from Earth-based materials. Its genetic makeup showed other signs of metal and salt and oxidative stress. So it grew, but it could have been happier.
Wow. Well, so were you surprised?
So I was the geologist on this study with two plant biologists. I was very surprised. Given what we know about the moon and its history and how different the soil is from soil on Earth, I was surprised that the plant grew at all. It could have easily just died and not taken root at all, but it grew.
Now, you only had a little bit of soil, it's my understanding, on loan from NASA. Is that right, to be able to do this?
That's correct. So our total allocation of lunar regolith was 12 grams, and there were 4 grams each from Apollo 11, Apollo 12, and Apollo 17.
That's like a few teaspoons, isn't it?
Right. And of those 4 grams from each of the different landing sites, those were divided into 4 so that we basically had 1 gram of soil for each particular plant. It was less than a teaspoon for it to grow in.
Fascinating stuff. And congratulations, Dr. Stephen Elardo, early career fellow with NASA and assistant professor at UF in the Department of Geological Sciences. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Pretty cool. Here's a little more good news for you. The Mayport Robotics Club in Atlantic Beach made history at a recent International Underwater Robotics Competition. The International Sea Perch Challenge took place in Maryland, hosted 138 teams from 25 states and 9 different countries. Teams were tasked with out-designing, out-building, and out-operating a custom-built remote-operated vehicle that could navigate complicated underwater missions. It was designed to mimic operations on the International Space Station. In the end, Mayport Coastal Science Middle School's three teams and an affiliated high school team won 13 trophies, 9 first place, 2 second place, and 1 third place, and 2 out of 3 class champ awards. Congrats to the Smarties at Mayport Coastal Sciences Middle School. Shout out to Jennifer Powers. This Jacksonville mom has an Amazon bestseller with her new book, I Am a Little Sister. Now, Jennifer was inspired to write this after her second daughter was born. Parents who want their younger daughters to feel special and important will be thrilled to read this book to them. As a parent of two girls, I can relate to that. Congrats to Jennifer Powers. Emma Concert Association has announced its 44th season of shows with live music and dance coming up starting this fall at the Lewis Auditorium at Flagler College. They'll kick off the season September 10th with The Queen's Cartoonists, a family-friendly show with live music from classic cartoons and contemporary animation synchronized to video projections of the original films. That sounds cool. The 6 band members from Queens, New York will lead the audience through this multimedia world, and this concert is for everyone. Other concerts include the Hollywood Concert Orchestra in October, the Gainesville Orchestra Holiday Concert in December, the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra in January, the Ocala Symphony in February, and Dance Alive National Ballet in March of next year. Tickets to all performances at emmaconcerts.com. Reserve your favorite seats in the Lewis Auditorium. And have fun at the kickoff of the Tedeschi Trucks summer tour this weekend at Daly's Place. We'll close with Moon, new music from the Tedeschi Trucks Band. Have a great listen. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
There's so much we search to find. Holding on to memories gone away. Knowing there's so much more to say. The world keeps on spinning.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.